Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and our special guest for the next 2 weeks will be Peter Fortunato. Peter is a longtime real estate investor and trainer. He's a libertarian and a capitalist. He believes that transactions, which you can be proud of, result from carefully conceived goals and plans followed by purposeful action and scrupulous documentation. And, you know, Peter, I'm looking forward to this because I've known you as a trainer for many, many years with a great reputation. And even the most experienced investors learn from you. As a matter of fact, come home with their head hurting when they're done. So welcome to our show.
Well, thank you very much. I'm looking forward to it, Bruce.
The off air, we just talked for a minute, and you got in the business in 1965, and then you told me you were 66 years old. And, you know, when I start doing the math, that's hardly enough time to be only 66. So why was real estate of such an interest so early?
Well, I was in high school before real estate. And when I was in high school, I was a sad, unhappy person. The second I got out of high school, my friends used to laugh because I was never the second person out the door. And I ran the 2 miles home every day just to put it behind me.
Okay.
I didn't like rules. I didn't like being told what to do. The guidance counselor got all upset when they asked, what would you like to do when you're out of school? And I said, I'd like to be unemployed. And they didn't think that was a good answer. And I had to tell them that what I meant was I wanted to be happily unemployed, which meant I wanted my assets rather than my time and labor to fund my lifestyle. And I was blessed to recognize that and therefore set a goal while I was still in high school.
That kind of a concept doesn't occur to most people that are 17 years old. They haven't even been exposed to it. So what did you see that you wanted to mimic, or did you just invent this from scratch?
Oh, it surely wasn't something I invented from scratch. I'm extraordinarily lucky in my family, and my parents had a business. When I was a little kid, I was a very fat little kid because they had an ice cream stand. And then when I was a little older, they had a department store. And then in 1957, they started a real estate and insurance business. My grandfather was a barber. My other grandfather was a contractor. My mom's uncle was a realtor. So I was lucky enough not to see a job. And so I didn't fall into that trap. And I was very uncomfortable with people telling me what to do. So when I got out of high school, I wanted to be unemployed. Well, I couldn't afford to be unemployed out of high school. I had to be self-employed. So at least it was my own fault what happened, be it good or bad, while I acquired or earned and saved a surplus and then began investing. It took me almost 3 years to get my first property, and it took me 10 years to get enough property so I no longer had to work. During that 10 years, I was a realtor. Probably the next half dozen years, I still represented some clients or old clients who I was unwilling to walk away from. And it's been a very, very, very long time since I've done anything like that, and I let my license go back in the early 80s.
Okay. So, all right, so that at some point you put in almost 15 years wearing a realtor hat and always with the thought of becoming independently wealthy, I guess would be the word. But your goal, you really have been trying to get the cash flow, which is kind of a different it's almost a different model. A lot of people think of, okay, I'm going to buy and sell this property and make a chunk of money. And your goal was to try and build a cash flow that was big enough to where you didn't have to work.
I was almost completely focused on annuity, building that annuity. And in fact, when you look back, the very first property I bought was a three-unit triplex in Beverly. And it was subject to a first. And this was in 67 or 8, subject to a first, subject to a home improvement loan, my entire life savings, which was $1,900, and $1,600 that I tried to get the seller to carry, and I was unsuccessful. And so turning to the only person who I thought might have some faith in me, I borrowed the money from my parents with my first really creative negotiation. No interest, no payments, no security, and no due date. I got the extra $1,600 and bought my first property.
Okay.
And it did not cash flow. Tax shelter was hardly an important thing to me when I was not yet earning $6,000 a year. I didn't know there'd be much appreciation, if any. I wasn't buying it under market, but I knew that when I was 44 years old, it'd be paid for, and I'd no longer have to send the payments to the first and second mortgage, and that meant I'd have the cash flow when I was 44.
So you actually were, you literally made that a conscious thought that if I hold on to this thing for the whole duration, I'll own something free and clear?
That's correct. And the properties that I acquired while I was in college, the majority of them are still owned by my family.
That's pretty astonishing, actually. Okay, who were your early mentors that, let's say, outside of your family? I can see that no one ever asked you, you know, when you graduated high school from your family, okay, well, who are you going to work for? It was almost, okay, what kind of business are you going to start?
Yeah, and I would have, you know, like I tell people in my classes, I would have dearly loved to own the Boston Celtics, but I was a little bit light. You know, I just couldn't quite get my arms around that big an investment. But working for myself, it was a natural to become a real estate agent because it meant I didn't need to have a location or an inventory to sell. I could sell your house and earn a commission, and I could afford to do that. I could truly hustle. I enjoyed learning, and so I could apply that to selling other people's houses and to exchanging, and that earned me a living and a reputation in the real estate community. That enabled me to earn until I could afford to start investing. And then the deals grew up and ultimately provided me with a cash flow that was enough so that I could stay home if I wanted to. Now, I do enjoy real estate and don't do anything else. I mean, I literally have no other life outside of this. And I spend all my time talking to friends and family and helping them whether they like it or not.
You know, a lot of people have a faulty idea of who an investor is. And, you know, just from your reputation, if I had a problem situation, sitting in front of somebody that really understands very creative ways to solve things is a big advantage. To be able to sit in front of that person rather than just say, okay, well, there's only one way to sell this. You got to do this.
Yeah. Yeah. And the fact is there's a million ways to make a deal, and only one of them is cash. And cash is usually wasteful and expensive, and I don't understand it. I don't understand why people don't see beyond doing the same as everybody else. When you look around America and see that 95% of Americans reach age 65 and they can't retire. So clearly the majority is not doing it right, and you just have to do things differently.
When you first started in real estate, let's say you said it was in the mid-60s.
Yeah.
What state was it in?
Massachusetts, North Shore of Boston.
And how was real estate viewed as far as I don't know, a product type. Was it considered an investment or just the place you lived in?
No, I think in California was the only place where the populace was infected with that business of, I can't just relax and enjoy my house. It's always going to be an investment. That has since spread across the country. But when I was growing up, most other places, there were indeed investors, but not every homeowner, you know, took their equity to bed with them last night, every night, cherishing it. And it was unusual to go to California and see that for me. The big deal for me in the 60s was that I became a real estate agent at 18, and now my dad already was. And so I had seen that since 57 when I was 10 years old. But I watched my dad, who was an extraordinary people person,
mm-hmm.
and a great mentor to me. But my dad was a residential real estate agent. And I've always been intrigued that realtors seem to always want to do residential, where my dad, absolutely all of his customers and clients would come back to him and do business again, and their next generation of the family would come back. But they bought a house every 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so I went to the investment side because I dealt with investors who bought 2, 3, 4 houses a year. And so I got to do repeat business without waiting a decade. And it always intrigued me that more people, more realtors, don't pursue that avenue.
The same is true with, I have a hard money loan business, and we have a hard money loan business specifically to loan to investors because they can bug you 10 times a year as opposed to once every 5.
Yeah.
So it's exactly the same theory. What were interest rates in the mid-60s?
In 1966, January, I lost my first sale because interest rates jumped to 6%. Now, the average house price was $17,900 for 3 bedrooms and 2 baths.
Okay, so that blew the payment up over $120, huh?
And the people said, no, until it comes down under 6%, I'm not buying. And because I was still 90 years old, I didn't have the backbone to say, buy the damn house. And to this day, one of those two people is still alive. And when I go to Massachusetts, and I drive by and see that she's still living in that apartment, I feel guilty because that would not happen to me once I had a little more confidence and was a little stronger.
Well, at least they did eventually get to below 6% again. It just took, 45 years.
Right, exactly. And it's funny, you go by and think, doggone, I had a responsibility to do a better job for them than that.
I think you bring up a very, very valid point. As investors, I think we owe it to whoever we're sitting across from to listen to their situation and then honestly use our experience to say, you know what, if I was in your seat, these would be the options I would consider. And when you recognize they're about to make a mistake, to me, doing it in a credible way and doing it from a seat of saying, I would do this if I were in your seat. And when they don't do that, having enough backbone, as you put it, to say, you're about to make a mistake, and I'm really not going to let you get away with that.
Well, it's funny how long, very long ago that was, and how much it still troubles me when I'm back home in my hometown, knowing that's there. Now, it doesn't haunt me, but I do realize it, and it bothers me. Another thing, I went into real estate at 18, and the realtors around me, we get on those caravans to go look at new houses in MLS. None of them were jealous of their knowledge. They sat with me. I can name 20 different agents who helped me to learn how to do the business, who showed me how deals went together and how deals fell apart. And the pride within the Board of Realtors up there in the Greater Salem Board on the North Shore of Boston was extraordinary. Those guys knew that they could do real estate like no one else could, and that's why they were professionals. And I now find that in the investment communities that I spend my time in, and maybe it does exist out there in realtors, but it was everywhere on the North Shore of Boston when I was starting in the late 60s.
What was interest rates were reasonable. Until like mid-70s or maybe early 70s, and all of a sudden it changed a great deal, was subject to buying prevalent in the 60s and early 70s? Is that?
Oh yeah. I mean, because prior to Wellenkamp out in California, and then it exploded after that. But prior to that, there were not do-on-sale clauses. And when they were added, many of the judges were saying, no, you made a 25- or 30-year loan. If you'd have wanted it to have an adjustable payment or an adjustable due date, you should have put that in the note. But then, of course, you have Darren St. Germain, and that due-on-sale issue changed the 30-year note into 30 years or until sold. Then, worse yet, we got the securitized loans, which made real estate much more dangerous for a lot of people. It's been an interesting story. I think when I talk to the to acquisition group, where I'm talking to my most basic classes, I look back on the single most important deal of my life was done when I was 21 or so. And I bought a three-family building on the North Shore of Boston from an old guy who was 47. And I bought his equity for $12,000. I gave him a note for that $12,000. It was $150 a month at 8% until paid. So okay. I bought the house with a promise.
Right.
And I bought, subject to a mortgage, to the Beverly Cooperative Bank in Beverly. And John, the gentleman who I bought it from, took me to the bank and said, look, I want to do this, but I don't want to do something behind the back of my lender. Because it was, you know, personal banking was the thing back then. And he introduced me to the banker, and I bought that property after the bank said to John, look, John, we lent the money to you, and if this young man doesn't pay us, we're coming after you.
Mm-hmm.
So John said, you know, that I have faith in this kid, plus I'm tired of the work. He's 21 and still optimistic, so I'm going to pass the burden to him.
Okay.
They made me sign an assumption agreement, and I assumed the bank, I assumed the loan of the bank. Well, that three-unit apartment building, which, again, we still have in the family, was the most important deal of my life because John passed away in June of 2000. And when he passed away, we had done 27 transactions with him and his family.
Wow.
I can't tell you how many referrals. I had financed five different properties with that bank. They had referred people to me. And that's one of the things that I am always trying to get across when I speak, is that every deal is a seed, and it's the minor part of the deal. It's the harvest it'll grow into. If you just do a good deal, do what you say, and stay in communication. I'm always surprised at the people who make a deal with someone and then never talk to them again. That's just weird.
That's completely common. I mean, that's 98% of our industry does one transaction per human being, and that's it.
Oh, boy. What a waste.
Well, you haven't taught enough people. That's it. We've got to get you out there more. Me and you'll have to do, we've never taught together. I'd probably love to do that in the next year or so. That would be, I'd enjoy that a lot.
Well, and your focus on numbers and demographics is so different than mine, because I'm never looking at the marketplace except as a big backdrop, because all the business I do is nose-to-nose with a human being. And so I'm not talking about the market in the United States or the market in California or the market in Seminole, Florida. I'm talking about the market that this man is experiencing. And so many, 45 years ago, I took Warren Harding's class, and Warren taught us that every opportunity is born of uncomfortable circumstances of ownership. And so my job is to go, given my goal, so I know what's in it for me, and discover one of those uncomfortable circumstances of ownership so I can help make a deal.
And uncomfortable situations can be very personal, and it may, when an uncomfortable ownership might be there's a railroad behind the house, but that's not the situation you buy. Uncomfortable situations that you buy usually are solved the second ownership transfers to you.
A common example here in Florida is the doctor told the people that they couldn't handle stairs anymore. That didn't mean the house changed. That didn't mean the house was less valuable. That didn't mean the market behind it was less valuable. It meant that to these people, that house was less valuable. My first property that I bought with the $1,600 from my dad with no interest and no payment, when I asked the people who owned that property, why would you sell a nice house like this? He had been offered a job 1,400 miles away from that house. Well, that house that was of little use to him and had an enormous cost to him if he had to commute 1,400 miles. So the house hadn't changed. His situation had changed. And that's always where I'm doing business. It's at a very personal level. We talked about, well, I talk all the time about value being subjective. And I actually have a notebook that I carry with me some of the time. Other times I just whip out a pen and do it on a pen, on a pad of paper or on a napkin. I put present position, and then I put a T, and I put on the right hand side, I say potential position. And I have them write down where they are now. And where they are now, maybe I've got a house that's 1,000 miles from my job. It maybe I got a house that has a $400 a month tax bill. I got to pay the electricity on that house. Insurance is expensive or not. A big problem, a critical problem, an uncomfortable circumstance for people is I've got an ungrateful relative living in the house. Well, I mean, it's amazing. People don't know what to do with that. And I can take that on. The thing is, I care enough to find out why would they sell a nice house like that. And having found that out, then there's the potential for me to make a deal.
So you really, what you're trying to do, and by the way, is it easy for you to get people to tell you the truth?
It is, but sometimes it's hard to get them to tell themselves the truth.
Okay.
They don't understand why. And I get people all the time who lie to me and lie to themselves and say that they want cash. And we know that no one wants the cash. When I was 19, of course, I had no hope of having any cash, so I had to find something other than cash they needed. I said to a couple, you really want only cash for this thing? And they go, yep, that's the thing. I said, well, okay, in the event, again, see, deal with Warren Harding, who taught us, do your discussing at the hypothetical level. So you make a hypothetical. In the event that I could do this, is there any reason why you wouldn't consider it? Jack Miller, you'd say, now, we're just talking. Don't hold me to this. We're just talking. But at the hypothetical level, they can explore with you a little bit.
Okay.
And so I said to them, so if I gave you $20,000 cash and I piled those Federal Reserve notes up here on your dining room table, you'd really take that and give me a deed to that nice house up on the lake? And they'd nod vigorously. Oh, yeah, of course we would. I said, okay, in the event that we did that, I'd go off and enjoy the house on the lake. And in 6 months, I'll come back here, and we can sit together and look at the 20,000 Federal Reserve notes sitting on your dining room table. And they always laughed. I said, don't be ridiculous. Of course they won't. I said, what do you mean they won't be there? Of course they're going to be there. You said there was nothing else in the world you wanted but those dollars. I thought you were going to build a shrine to those dollars. And then they say, oh, no, those were to pay medical bills. Those were to send Sally to college. Those were to buy a new car because you got to commute long distances. Those were to pay off debt. Those were to help a relative. Whatever it is, no one wants the dollars. The dollars are simply a conduit from something they like less to something they like more.
Okay.
And if you see that, then you can help them do business. If they don't see it, it's hard to help them because they're just dealing in a different world. But I typically use seller financing where I trade a promise for property. Other times I'll trade properties for properties. But I virtually never trade dollars for properties. Now, when I trade a note for properties, I just actually get a deal on a little house here.
Peter, we've got 30.
And I said, look, I'll give you $300 a month for 30 years. And she said, well, how much are you paying me? What's the price? I said, I don't care. I said, I'll give you $60,000 at 4.5% 30 years, or I'll give you $50,000 at 6% for 30 years, or I'll give you $42,000 at 7.5% 30 years. But anyone, in all of those cases, you're getting $300 a month for 30 years.
Peter, I've got to end this segment. Okay. We've been with Peter Fortunato. Peter, it's been great talking with you. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Bruce.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.